1964. Russian astronomers informed the world that they had possibly received signals from an extraterrestrial supercivilization. Radio star CTA-102 was listed under catalog number 102 by radio astronomers of the California Institute of Technology, hence its name. The astronomer Sholomitsky said in the lecture room of the Sternberg Astrological Institute in Moscow on April 13, 1965, "At the end of September and the beginning of October 1964, the radiation energy from CTA-102 was much stronger, but only for a short time. Then it diminished again. We registered this and waited. Toward the end of the year, the intensity of the source suddenly increased again. It reached a second peak exactly 100 days after the first record was taken." His chief, Professor I.S. Shklovsky, added that such fluctuations in radiation were very unusual. Meanwhile, Dutch astrophysicist Martin Schmidt has found out by exact measurements that CTA-102 must be about 10 billion light-years from the Earth. That means that if the radio beams originated from intelligent beings, they must have been radiated 10 billion years ago. But according to the calculations of present-day research, our planet simply did not exist at that time. This realization could mean a kind of coup de grace in the search for other living beings in the universe. But if the search for life in the universe had no chance of success, astrophysicists in America and Russia, at Jodrell Bank, England, and at Stockert, near Bonn in Germany, would not be concentrating their research on what are known as radio stars and quasars with enormous directional antennae. The fixed stars Epsilon Eridani and Tau Ceti are respectively 10.2 and 11.8 light-years away from us. So radio waves aimed at these neighbors would be about 11 light-years underway, and an answer from them could reasonably reach us in 22 years. Radio communications with more distant stars would take correspondingly longer. Civilizations situated at distances reckoned in millions of light-years are quite unsuitable to contact by means of radio waves. But our radio waves are our only technical means of making such attempts. For example, we could also make ourselves optically noticeable. A powerful laser beam directed at Mars or Jupiter could not remain unnoticed, provided that intelligent living beings are in existence there. Laser is the abbreviation for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Another somewhat fantastic-sounding possibility would be to cultivate vast areas of soil so that tremendous color contrasts appeared, which at the same time represented a geometrical or mathematical symbol of universal validity. One audacious but perfectly realizable idea, a gigantic equilateral triangle would have its 600-mile-long sides sown with potatoes. In this enormous triangle, a circle would be sown with wheat. In this way, a vast yellow circle, surrounded by a green equilateral triangle, would appear every summer. Incidentally, a most useful and productive experiment. But if there are unknown intelligences that seek us as we seek them, the coloring of circle and triangle would be a hint to them that these shapes were no freaks of nature. Someone has also advocated erecting a chain of lighthouses which radiate their lights vertically. The resultant sea of light should be arranged to have the shape of a model of an atom. There are all kinds of suggestions based on the premise that someone, somewhere, is watching our planet. Are we tackling the problem the wrong way by limiting ourselves to the kind of means suggested above? However skeptical or antipathetic we may be to everything occult, we cannot avoid looking into some as yet inexplicable physical phenomena. For example, the thought transference between intelligent brains that is proved on a broad scientific basis, but not yet explained. In the parapsychological departments of many important universities, previously unexplained phenomena, such as clairvoyance, visions, and thought transference, are being investigated with accurate scientific methods. In the process, all ghost and bogey stories from dubious occult sources or inspired by religious mania are separated and rejected. In this field of research, which was absolutely taboo until quite recently, we have made important advances. In August 1959, the Nautilus experiment came to an end. It not only demonstrated the possibility of thought transference, but also showed that mental communication between human brains can be stronger than radio waves. This was the experiment. Thousands of miles away from the thought transmitter, the submarine Nautilus dived several hundred feet below the surface. All radio communications were interrupted, for even today radio waves do not penetrate to any appreciable depth. On the other hand, mental communication between Mr. X and Mr. Y did function. After such scientific tests, one asks oneself what else the human brain is capable of. Can it make mental communications faster than light? The Case affair, which has passed into the annals of scientific literature, stimulates such suppositions. Edgar Case, a simple farmer's son from Kentucky, had no idea of the fantastic capabilities that were hidden in his brain. Although he died on January 5, 1945, doctors and psychologists are still busy evaluating his actions. The strict American Medical Association gave Edgar Case permission to hold consultations, although he was not a doctor. Edgar Case fell ill in his early youth. He was racked by cramps. High fever was consuming his body. He fell into a coma. While the doctors were trying in vain to bring the boy back to consciousness, Edgar suddenly began to speak loudly and clearly. He explained why he was ill, named some remedies which he needed, and told them to prepare a paste from certain ingredients and smear his spine with it. Doctors and relatives were astounded because they had no idea where the boy had got this knowledge and the technical language, which was quite unknown to him. Edgar got progressively and visibly better after treatment with the medications he had named. The incident was the talk of the state. Since Edgar had spoken in a coma, many people suggested that he should be hypnotized in order to entice suggestions for cures from him. Edgar would not have this at any price. Not until a friend of his fell ill did he dictate a precise prescription using Latin words which he had never heard or even seen before. A week later, his friend was better again. If the first case was soon forgotten as a minor sensation that was not to be taken seriously scientifically, the second incident caused the AMA to set up a commission which was to make reports if anything of the kind happened again and to put down in writing every single detail. In a sleeping state, Case had knowledge and abilities which would normally be the result only of much consultation. Once Case prescribed for a very wealthy patient a medicine that could not be procured anywhere. This man put several advertisements in widely circulating newspapers, including international ones. A young doctor wrote from Paris, saying that his father had made the medicine years ago, but that production had long been discontinued. The composition of this medicine was identical with the detailed ingredients supplied by Edgar Case. Later, Case prescribed a medicine and also named the address of a laboratory in a town a long way away. A telephone call showed that the preparation was just being developed. A formula had been worked out. They were looking for a name, but it was not yet on sale to chemists. The professional doctors on the commission were no believers in telepathy. They investigated soberly and objectively, verified what they observed, and knew that Case had never had a medical book in his hands in his life. Besieged on all sides and from all over the world, Case gave two consultations a day, always in the presence of doctors and always without accepting fees. His diagnoses and therapeutical prescriptions were accurate, but when he came out of his trance, he could not remember what he had said. When doctors on the commission asked him how he arrived at his diagnoses, Case supposed that he could put himself in contact with any brain required and gather the information he needed for his diagnoses from it. But as the patient's brain knew exactly what his body lacked, it was all very simple. He asked the brain of the sick person, and then he sought out the brain in the world which could tell him what should be done. He himself, declared Case, was only a part of all brains. An astonishing idea, which, transferred to the realm of technology, would look something like this. In New York, a monster computer would be fed with all the known data on physics. Whenever and from wherever the computer was interrogated, it would give its answer in fractions of a second. Another computer might be in Zurich with the whole of medical knowledge stored inside it. One in Moscow would be stuffed with all the facts about biology. Another in Cairo would have no gaps in its astronomical knowledge. In short, all the knowledge in the world, arranged by branches, would be stored in various centers. Connected by radio, the computer in Cairo, if asked for medical information, would pass on the questions to the computer in Zurich in a hundredth of a second. Edgar Cayce's brain must have functioned in much the same way as this perfectly credible and already technically feasible computer link-up. I now put forward the bold speculation. What if all, or even only a few highly trained human brains, have unknown forms of energy at their disposal, and possess the ability to make contact with all living beings? We know frighteningly little about the functions and potentialities of the human brain, but it is known that only one-tenth of the cortex functions in the brain of a healthy man. What are the remaining nine-tenths doing? The fact that men have recovered from incurable diseases by willpower and nothing else is well known and scientifically documented. Perhaps a gear unknown to us has been engaged, setting an additional tenth or two-tenths of the cortex working. If we assume the fantastic idea that the strongest forms of energy operate in the brain, then a strong mental impulse would be noticeable everywhere simultaneously. If science succeeds in making such a wild idea demonstrable, it could mean that all intelligences in the universe belong to the same unknown structure. Let me give an example. If a strong electrical impulse is released at any point in a tank full of millions of bacteria, it is felt everywhere and by every species of bacteria. The surge of current is perceived everywhere at the same moment. I quite realize that this comparison is imperfect, for electricity is a known form of energy and dependent on the speed of light. I am concerned with a form of energy that is available and effective everywhere simultaneously. I imagine an as-yet unidentified form of energy which will one day make the incomprehensible comprehensible. In order to give a semblance of probability to the extraordinary idea, I shall quote the report of an experiment carried out May 29 and 30, 1965. In its scope and nature, it must be unique. On these 2 days, 1,008 people concentrated at the same time, indeed at the same second, on pictures, sentences, and groups of symbols, which were radiated into the universe by them with concentrated power. The fact of the mass experiment is not the only astonishing thing. The results are strange, too. None of the participants knew any of the others. They lived hundreds of miles apart. Yet 2.7% of the participants answered on forms that they had seen a picture, namely the model of an atom. Since collusion on the part of the guinea pigs was impossible, it is surprising that as many as 2.7% should have seen the same mental picture. Telepathy? Hocus-pocus? Chance? Admittedly, the whole thing is a science fiction subject, but the experiment, organized by scientists, did take place. It is quite obvious that we don't know everything yet. The result of an experiment by a group of physicists at Princeton University is equally inexplicable. While investigating the disintegration of electronically neutral K mesons, they reached a result that was theoretically impossible because it contradicted a long-established principle of nuclear physics. One more extraordinary example. Einstein's theory of relativity says that mass and energy are only different forms of one and the same phenomenon, E equals mc squared. Put simply, mass can literally be produced from the void. If a strong beam of energy is shot past a heavy atomic nucleus, the beam of energy disappears into the strong electrical field of energy of the atomic nucleus, and an electron and a positron appear in its place. Energy in the form of a beam has changed into the mass of two electrons. To the mind that has not been trained scientifically, the process seems crazy, and yet it takes place exactly like that. There is nothing to be ashamed of if you cannot follow Einstein. One scientist called him the Great Solitary because he could discuss his theory with only a dozen or so of his contemporaries. After this excursion into the still unexplored fields of thought transference and the functions of the human brain, let us turn back to our theme again. It is no longer a secret that in November 1961, in the National Radio Astronomy Observatory at Green Bank, West Virginia, 11 authorities met at a secret conference. Here, too, the theme of the conference was the question of the existence of extraterrestrial intelligences. The scientists, among them Giuseppe Cocconi, Su-Shu Huang, Philip Morrison, Frank Drake, Otto Struve, and Carl Sagan, as well as the Nobel Prize winner Melvin Kelvin, collaborated at the end of the conference on what is known as the Green Bank Formula. According to this formula, there are at any moment in our galaxy alone 50 million different civilizations which are either trying to get in touch with us or waiting for a sign from other planets. The terms of the Green Bank Formula take into account all the aspects in question, but in addition, the scientists allotted two values to each term, a normal value admissible according to our present state of knowledge, and an absolute minimum value. In this formula, R sub plus equals the average annual number of new stars that are like our sun. F sub p equals the number of stars with possible living beings. N sub e equals the average number of planets which orbit the ecosphere of their sun and so have adequate premises for the development of life by human standards. F sub L equals the number of planets favored in this way on which life has actually developed. F sub I equals the number of planets which are populated by intelligences with their own ability to act during the lifetime of their sun. F sub C equals the number of planets inhabited by intelligences that already have a developed technical civilization. L equals the lifespan of a civilization, for only very long-lasting civilizations could encounter each other, given the vast distances in the universe. If we take the lowest possible figures for all terms in this formula, we get N equals 40. But if we take the admissible maximum value, we get N equals 50 million. In other words, in the most unfavorable case, the fantastic Green Bank formula calculates that there are 40 groups of intelligences in our Milky Way who are seeking contact with other intelligences. The most audacious possibility gives 50 million unknown intelligences who are waiting for a sign from the cosmos. All the Green Bank calculations are based not on present astronomical figures, but on the number of stars in our Milky Way since it existed. If we accept the formula of this scientific brain trust, civilizations with more advanced technologies than ours may have existed hundreds of thousands of years ago, a fact that supports the theory put forward here of visits by gods from the cosmos in the dawn of time. American astrobiologist Dr. Carl Sagan assures us that according to statistical calculations alone, the possibility exists that our Earth may have been visited by representatives of an extraterrestrial civilization at least once in the course of its history. Fantasy and wishful thinking may be concealed in all the deliberations and suppositions, but the Green Bank formula is a mathematical formula, and thus far removed from mere speculation. A new branch of science is in the process of formation, what is known as exobiology. New branches of science always find it difficult to achieve recognition. Exobiology would certainly find it harder to find acceptance if recognized personalities were not already devoting their work to this new field of research, which tackles extraterrestrial life with complete impartiality. What better proof of the seriousness of this new science than a group of the names which subscribe to it? Dr. Freeman Quimby, chief of the NASA Exobiological Program. Ira Bly, NASA. Joshua Lederberg, NASA. L.P. Smith, NASA. R.E. Kodge, NASA. Richard Young, NASA. H.S. Brown, California Institute of Technology. Edward Purcell, Professor of Physics at Harvard University. R.N. Bracewells, Radio Astronomy Institute of Stanford. Charles Townes, Nobel Prize for Physics, 1964. I.S. Shklovsky, Sternberg Institute, Moscow. N.S. Kardashev, Sternberg Institute, Moscow. Sir Bernard Lovell, Jodrell Bank, Werner von Braun, Hermann Oberth, von Braun's teacher Ernst Stuhlinger, Eugene Sanger, and many others. These names are representative of many thousands of exobiologists all over the world. The desire of all these men is to break through the taboos, to tear down the walls of lethargy, which until now have always surrounded the desert areas of research, which are specifically singled out in this book. In the face of all the opposition, exobiology exists, and one day it may become the most interesting and important field of research. But how can a proof of life in the universe be produced until someone has been there? There are statistics and calculations that definitely favor the idea of extraterrestrial life. There is the evidence of bacteria and spores in space. The search for unknown intelligences has begun, but has not yet produced results that are measurable, demonstrable, and convincing. What we need are verifications of theories, proofs of suppositions still disqualified as utopian today. NASA has a research program ready that is intended to produce evidence of unknown life in the cosmos. 8 different probes, each one as unique as it is complicated, are to show evidence of life on planets in our solar system. The following are the probes planned: optical rotary dispersion profiles, the Multivator, the Vidicon microscope, the J-band life detector, the radioisotope biochemical probe, the mass spectrometer, the Wolf trap, the ultraviolet spectrophotometer. A few hints as to what is hidden behind these technical titles that are double Dutch to the layman. Optical rotary dispersion profiles is the name of a laboratory probe with a rotary searchlight. Once landed on a planet, this light begins to emit beams and search for molecules. Molecules are well-known prerequisites for every kind of life. One of these molecules is the large spiral-shaped DNS molecule, which consists of 3 chemical combinations arranged next to one another: nitrogen, sugar, and phosphoric acid. When the radiated light strikes such a molecule, the search beam is interrupted because the nitrogen base adenine, in chemical association with sugar, has an optically active effect. Since the sugar combination in the DNS molecule is optically active, the search beam of the probe has only to encounter a sugar-adenine combination to produce an immediate signal that, automatically sent to Earth, would provide proof of life on an unknown planet. The Multivator consists of a probe weighing barely 1 pound, which is carried by a rocket as light baggage and ejected when near the planet. This miniature laboratory is then in a position to conduct as many as 15 different experiments and transmit their results to Earth. The radioisotope biochemical probe is the official name of a probe developed under the nickname Gulliver. It is intended to carry out a soft landing on the surface of another planet, and immediately afterward, to shoot out 3 45-long sticky ropes in various directions. In a few minutes, these ropes will be automatically withdrawn into the probe. Whatever stays clinging to the ropes, dust, microbes, or any kind of biochemical substances, will be immersed in a liquid culture medium. A part of this culture solution is enriched with the radioactive carbon isotope C14. The microorganisms introduced would logically have to produce carbon dioxide, CO2, through their metabolism. The gas carbon dioxide can easily be separated from the liquid culture and led to a measuring apparatus which measures the radioactivity of the gas containing C14 nuclei and radios the results to Earth. The Wolf trap, a mini-laboratory, was originally called Bug Detector by its inventor, but his collaborators rechristened it because their chief is called Professor Wolf Vishniak. The Wolf trap is also supposed to make a soft landing on another planet and then extend a vacuum tube with a very fragile tip. When the tube touches the ground, the tip breaks and soil samples of all kinds will be sucked into the vacuum created. Once again, the probe contains various sterile culture mediums, which guarantee every kind of bacteria a rapid growth. This multiplication of the bacteria makes the liquid medium cloudy, and the pH value, the degree of acidity of the liquid, also changes. Both changes can be easily and accurately measured. The cloudiness of the liquid, with the help of a beam of light and a photocell, the change in the acid content by an electrical pH measurement. These results would also enable us to make the conclusions about existing unknown life. Millions of dollars will be spent on the NASA program and coordinated research for the investigation and proof of extraterrestrial life. The first bioprobes will be sent to Mars. Undoubtedly, man will soon follow the mini-laboratories, which are the forerunners. The senior officials of NASA are unanimous in saying that the first astronauts will land on Mars by September 23, 1986, at the latest. This precise date has a reason. 1986 will be a year with little solar activity. Dr. von Braun supports the view that men could land on Mars as early as 1982. NASA does not lack the technical resources, only an adequate and unbroken financial grant from Congress. In addition to all the current American responsibilities, 2 money swallowers, such as the war in Vietnam and the space program, are a heavy burden for even the richest nation in the world. The plan for travel to Mars exists. The Mars spaceship has been designed. It only needs to be built as well. A model of it stands on the desk of an unusual man in Huntsville, Dr. Ernst Stirlinger. Stirlinger is director of the Research Project Laboratory, which is part of the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. He employs more than 100 scientific collaborators in his laboratories. They experiment in plasma, nuclear, and thermal physics, and also occupy themselves with the basic research for projects pointing into the future. The research for the electric rocket motor of the future is forever linked with the name of Dr. Stirlinger. He is the designer of the Mars spaceship, which will carry men to the red planet in our century. Dr. Stirlinger was brought to the United States soon after World War II by his friend Dr. Werner von Braun. In Fort Bliss, they made rockets for the Air Force. Accompanied by 162 fellow countrymen, the two rocket pioneers moved to Huntsville after the outbreak of the Korean War in order to conjure up a project such as even America, accustomed as it is to gigantomania, has never seen before. In those days, Huntsville was a small, sleepy nest on the edge of the Appalachian Mountains. With the arrival of the rocket men, the little cotton town turned into a circus. Factories, rocket testing platforms, laboratories, giant hangars, and corrugated iron offices shot up from the ground breathtakingly fast in a few years. Today, more than 150,000 people live in Huntsville. The little town has awakened from its sleep, and its inhabitants have become enthusiastic space fans. When the first Redstone rockets thundered away from the testing platform, many Huntsvilleites ran down into their cellars in panic. Nowadays, when a Saturn rocket is tested, and a roar fills the air as if the world were coming to an end in the next second, nobody takes any notice. Huntsvilleites always carry their earplugs with them, just as Londoners carry their umbrellas. They call their town simply Rocket City, and if Congress does not grant the hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars demanded for space travel, they get bad-tempered and start agitating. They have every reason to be proud of their Germans and NASA, for Huntsville has grown into the biggest NASA center of all. Here the rockets that make headlines all over the world are thought up and designed, from the little Redstone to the gigantic Saturn V. At launching, the tanks are filled with some 880,000 gallons of highly explosive fuel, which develops a propulsive force of 150 million horsepower. The giant rocket weighs almost 3,000 tons. In Huntsville, some 7,000 technicians, engineers, and scientists of related disciplines are working under Werner von Braun toward the great goal, the conquest of space. In 1967, about 300,000 scientists of all kinds were working on America's global space program. More than 20,000 industrial firms are working for the greatest research undertaking in history. When I visited Huntsville, Austrian scientist Dr. Scherer told me that the research groups constantly had to develop new articles which had never before been produced anywhere in the world. "Look here," he said, and showed a large cylinder from which came a humming, rumbling noise. "And there we are conducting lubricating experiments in an absolute vacuum. Do you know that we cannot use any of the countless lubricants produced in the world? They lose all their lubricating qualities in space. With available lubricants, even a simple electromotor stops functioning after at most half an hour in airless space. What else could we do but invent a lubricant which works perfectly even in an absolute vacuum?" A terrible groaning and whining came from another room. Two tremendous vices, firmly anchored to the floor, were trying to pull a 4-inch thick sheet of metal to pieces. "Another series of experiments that we would willingly dispense with," said Dr. Scherer. "But our experience has shown that existing metal alloys do not stand up to the stresses of space. So we must find ones that meet our requirements. That is the reason for these tensile probes and fatigue experiments under every conceivable kind of space situation. We also have to develop new welding techniques. The welded joints must be subjected to cold, heat, vibration, tensile strength, and pressure tests, so that we can find out the limits at which a welded joint breaks." The hostess, who accompanied me, looked at her watch. Dr. Scherer looked at his watch. Everyone was looking at his watch. NASA personnel, of course, don't notice it anymore. The visitor finds it curious at first, but he soon gets used to it, for looking at one's watch is a standard gesture of NASA personnel at Cape Kennedy, Houston, and Huntsville. They always seem to be making a countdown. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Rides and walks through halls, corridors, and doors led, after many more security controls, to Mr. Pauli, who also comes from German-speaking Europe and has been working for NASA for 13 years. I had a white helmet bearing the NASA symbol crammed on my head. Mr. Pauli took me to the testing platform of the Saturn V. The simple words, testing platform, mean a concrete colossus that weighs several hundred tons, is several stories high, has lifts and cranes leading to it, and is surrounded by ramps in which a bewildering network of many miles of cables is installed. Once it is ignited, Saturn V makes a din which can be heard 12 miles from the launching ground. The testing platform, deeply anchored in rock and concrete, rises as much as 3 inches from its base during such trials, while 333,000 gallons of water per second are pumped through a sluice for cooling purposes. Merely for cooling trial rockets on the testing platform, NASA had to build a pumping works that could supply a city the size of Manchester with drinking water. A single firing test costs a cool $14 million. Space does not come cheaply. Huntsville is one of the many NASA centers. The reader should note them because later they may become the departure stations for space flights. Army Research Center, Moffett Field, California. Electronics Research Center, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Flight Research Center, Edwards, California. Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, California. John F. Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Langley Research Center, Houston, Virginia. Lewis Research Center, Cleveland, Ohio. Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas. Nuclear Rocket Development Station, Jackass Flats, Nevada. Pacific Launch Operations Office, Lompoc, California. Wallops Station, Wallops Island, Virginia. Western Operations Office, Santa Monica, California. NASA Headquarters, Washington, D.C. The spaceship industry has long overtaken the automobile industry as a pacesetter in the market. On July 1, 1967, 22,828 people were working at the Cape Kennedy Space Center. The annual budget for this station alone amounted to $475,784,000 in 1967. All that because a few crazy people want to go to the moon. I think I have already given sufficient convincing examples of what we owe research into space travel today, and these only as byproducts, ranging from objects in everyday use to complicated medical apparatus which saves people's lives every hour of the day all over the world. The super technology in the course of development is truly no scourge of mankind. It is carrying mankind into the future, which begins anew daily with 7-league boots. The author had a chance to ask Wernher von Braun for his opinion of the hypotheses put forward in this book. Dr. von Braun, do you consider it possible that we shall find life on other planets in our solar system? I consider it possible that we shall come across lower forms of life on the planet Mars. Do you consider it possible that we are not the only intelligences in the universe? I consider it extremely probable that not only plant and animal life, but also intelligent living creatures exist in the infinite reaches of the universe. The discovery of such life is a most fascinating and interesting task, but considering the enormous distances between our own and other solar systems, and the still greater distances between our galaxy and other galactic systems, it is doubtful whether we shall succeed in proving the existence of such forms of life, or getting into direct communication with them. Is it conceivable that older, technically more advanced intelligences live or have lived in our galaxy? Up to the present, we have no proof or indication that older and technically more advanced living beings than ourselves live or have lived in our galaxy. However, on the basis of statistical and philosophical considerations, I am convinced of the existence of such advanced living beings, but I must emphasize that we have no firm scientific basis for this conviction. Is there a possibility that older intelligences could have paid a visit to our Earth in the dim mists of time? I won't deny this possibility, but to the best of my knowledge, no archaeological studies have so far provided any basis for that kind of speculation. Here my conversation with the father of the Saturn rocket ended. I could not tell him in detail about all the remarkable discoveries, the absurdities, the old books handed down to us as unsolved puzzles, the countless questions that archaeological finds force upon us when considered with space eyes. But Dr. von Braun awaits the documentation of this book. Chapter 12. Tomorrow. Where do we stand today? Will man dominate space one day? Did unknown beings from the infinite reaches of the cosmos visit the Earth in the remote past? Are unknown intelligences somewhere in the universe trying to make contact with us? Is our age, with its discoveries that are taking the future by storm, really so terrible? Should the most shattering results of research be kept secret? Will medicine and biology discover a way of restoring deep frozen men to life? Will men from Earth colonize new planets? Will they mate with the inhabitants they find there? Will men create a second, third, and fourth Earth? Will special robots replace surgeons one day? Will hospitals in the year 2100 be spare parts stores for defective men? Will it become possible in the distant future to prolong man's life indefinitely with artificial hearts, lungs, kidneys, etc.? Will Huxley's brave new world come true one day in all its improbability and chilling inhumanity? A compendium of such questions could easily get as big as the New York telephone directory. Not a day passes without something brand new being invented somewhere in the world. Every day another question can be struck from the list of impossibilities as answered. Edinburgh University received a preliminary grant of $6,480,000 from the Nuffield Trust for the development of an intelligent computer. The prototype of this computer was put into conversation with a patient, and afterward the patient would not believe that he had been talking to a machine. Dr. Donald Michie, who designed this computer, claimed that his machine was beginning to develop a personal life. The new science is called futurology. Its goal is the planning and detailed investigation and understanding of the future by all the technical and mental means available. Think tanks are springing up all over the world. What they amount to are monasteries of scientists of today who are thinking for tomorrow. There are 164 of these think tanks at work in America alone. They accept commissions from the government and heavy industry. The most celebrated think tank is the RAND Corporation at Santa Monica in California. The U.S. Air Force was responsible for its foundation in 1945. The reason? High-ranking officers wanted a research program of their own on intercontinental warfare. Some 850 selected scientific authorities now work in the two-story, magnificently laid-out research center. The first ideas and plans for the foundations of mankind's most improbable adventures are born here. As early as 1946, RAND scientists evaluated the military usefulness of a spaceship. When RAND developed the program for various satellites in 1951, it was called Utopian. Since RAND has been functioning, the world can thank this research center for 3,000 accurate accounts of hitherto unobserved phenomena. RAND scientists have published more than 110 books, which have advanced our culture and civilization immeasurably. There is no end in sight to this research work, and there is unlikely to be one. Similar work for the future is being done in the following institutes: the Hudson Institute at Harmon-on-Hudson, New York, the Tempo Center for Advanced Studies belonging to General Electric at Santa Barbara, California, the Arthur Little Institute at Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Battle Institute at Columbus, Ohio. Governments and big business simply cannot manage without these thinkers for the future. Governments have to decide on their military plans far in advance. Big businesses have to calculate their investments for decades ahead. Futurology will have to plan the development of capital cities for 100 or more years ahead. Equipped with present-day knowledge, it would not be difficult to estimate, say, the development of Mexico for the next 50 years. In making such a forecast, every conceivable fact would be taken into account, such as the existing technology, means of communication and transport, political currents, and Mexico's potential opponents. If this forecast is possible today, unknown intelligences could certainly have made such a forecast for the planet Earth 10,000 years ago. Mankind has a compulsive urge to think out in advance and investigate the future with all the potentialities at its command. Without this study of the future, we would probably have no chance of unraveling our past. For who knows whether important clues for the unraveling of our past do not lie around the archaeological sites, whether we do not trample them heedlessly underfoot because we do not know what to make of them. That is the very reason why I advocated a utopian archaeological year. In the same way that I am unable to believe in the wisdom of the old patterns of thought, I do not ask others to believe my hypothesis. Nevertheless, I expect and hope that the time will soon be ripe to attack the riddle of the past without prejudice, making full use of all the refinements of technology. It is not our fault that there are millions of other planets in the universe. It is not our fault that the Japanese statue of Tokomai, which is many thousands of years old, has modern fastenings and eye apertures on its helmet. It is not our fault that the stone relief from Palenque exists. It is not our fault that Admiral Piri Reis did not burn his ancient maps. It is not our fault that the old books and traditions of human history exhibit so many absurdities. But it is our fault if we know all this, but disregard it and refuse to take it seriously. Man has a magnificent future ahead of him, a future which will far surpass his magnificent past. We need space research and research into the future and the courage to tackle projects that now seem impossible. For example, the project of concerted research into the past, which can bring us valuable memories of the future. Memories which will then be proved and which will illuminate the history of mankind for the blessing of future generations. This concludes Chariots of the Gods. Tantor Audio is proud to present a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken.
Eric von Daniken's first book, Chariots of the Gods, became a worldwide bestseller following its publication in 1968 and has been translated into 32 languages. Tantor Audio is very pleased to be releasing for the first time on audio four of Mr. von Daniken's books, Chariots of the Gods, Twilight of the Gods, The Eyes of the Sphinx, and History is Wrong. And we are very honored to have Mr. von Daniken with us today as our guest. Welcome, Mr. von Daniken.
Well, welcome myself. Happy to be with you on the phone.
Thank you so much. Now, of course, you are the Swiss author best known for your claims about extraterrestrial influences. And this is a topic that has really been popular since 1968, since your very first book, Chariots of the Gods. And, of course, we've had movies and a television series, and there's a current series on History Channel now about ancient aliens, and all of this can be attributed to your early work. And so I was wondering if you could tell the listeners, what was it, what were your earliest experiences, and at what age did you first have the feeling about these ancient aliens?
I was educated in Switzerland. I am Swiss, and I was educated for 6 years in a Swiss boarding school led by Jesuits. So I was a strict Catholic. And in my boarding school, we had also to learn Latin and Greek. And we had to make translations for some parts of the Old Testament of the Bible. Now, you have to understand, I was a very, very deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a deep believer in God. I'm one of these persons who still pray. But for me, as a young man, God had to have a few minimal qualities. For example, God would never make mistake, or God would never use a vehicle to move from one point to the other, because God is all over. We say he's omnipotent, etc. Now, by making translations from the Bible, especially from the book of the prophet Ezekiel, I had of a certain doubt in my own religious education, because the prophet Ezekiel describes, by the way, in the first person, as an eyewitness. He describes a vehicle who descends from the sky. He describes the wheel of the vehicle, the wings of the vehicle. He describes the noise which the vehicle makes, etc. He calls all this the splendorness of God. Now, of course, as a young man, I asked my professors, what's this all about? And the professor said, well, Eric, you have to consider this as a vision. Ezekiel had a vision, but I could not believe in the vision because it was too natural, the explanation. So I simply wanted to know if other communities in antiquity also have similar stories like the ones we find in the Bible. And so I started to research. And finally, I came up with a hypothesis, or with a speculation, if you wish, that our ancestors must have seen some extraterrestrials long, long time ago. Now, at that time, our ancestors were Stone Age people. They could not understand what was going on. So they believed, of course, erroneously, they believed that these extraterrestrials were some kind of gods. We all know that there is only one God. But that was the misunderstanding in the past, and that's how it all started.
It's almost 50 years since the publication of your first book. Why is this still capturing the imagination of young people and older people?
Because so many things have changed in the past 50 years. You see, after Chariots of the Gods, I was, for example, attacked by some of the scientific community. They say this is all ridiculous, because no extraterrestrial, even if they would exist, they would never be able to visit us because there are distances with the speed of light and the next stars are far away, so they could never reach us. In the meantime, we see quite possibilities how interstellar space travel would be possible. Or I speculated at that time that some of these gods made some genetic experiments with our ancestors. Of course, I was ridiculed. In the meantime, we know that such genetic experiments are possible. Our genetics are doing it every day. And so on, the situation has changed completely. Also, I know, and we know, much more of the old texts today than we knew 50 years ago. So many new old texts have been found in ruins all over the world. And this is my speciality, to find it and if possible to translate it, and if I'm not able to translate it, so I hire some professors who make translations. You see, in the beginning, in the old texts, we always hear, for example, that some humans, some of our forefathers, were taken into the heaven. Now the word heaven, in the religious sense, means a place of happiness, a place where you are united with God, with the Lord, after death. In the meantime, we understand that the word heaven in ancient texts was not just a religious meaning. Heaven was also space. So space is not the same thing as heaven. You see, the sky is up there. Some of our ancestors were taken into the sky and were brought back.
You have over 24 books, and they've been translated into 20 or more languages. Can you tell us, are you working on any books currently?
Of course, I'm always working. You see, I have a very big archive, and in my archive, I have about 60,000 pictures, which I made over the last 50 years worldwide. And at the moment, I'm working on 5 volumes of a picture book. Every volume has just 200 pictures, so with 5 volumes, we will have altogether 1,000 pictures. I show the most incredible things in archaeology which exists around the world.
Before we end our conversation today, I think my son, who is a big fan of yours and of ancient aliens, would like me to ask you, what do you think is going to happen in 2012?
The Maya calendar has a starting date. And the starting date of the Maya calendar, if we translate it into our Christian calendar, is August 14th, 3000. 114 BC. That was the starting point of the Maya calendar. Now, every normal calendar has no ending date. For example, in our Christian calendar, we can go on and count and count. We can say, now it's September 2014 or so on. Not in the Maya calendar. The Maya calendar has an ending date. and you can translate the ending date into our calendar. And out comes December 23rd, 2012. Then the Maya calendar ends. Now we have Maya writings, even in some stone pyramids, where they say, at that date, a god with the name Bolon Yokte, that's the name of one of these gods, Bolon Yokte will return to Earth. So that would mean that on December 23rd, 2012, some extraterrestrials would return to Earth. Fantastic. The only problem we have is the calculation of the calendar. The specialists in Maya language, Maya astronomy, have calculated the starting point, as I said before, to August 14, 3114 BC. If this translation into our calendar is wrong, then the end date, 2012, will be wrong too. So we have traditions of the Maya which says some of the gods will return, but I would never count on the date. They will return one day, but if this will be in December 2012 or later or maybe earlier, nobody knows.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.